The following presentation was recorded at the 2001 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Is it? The teacher is critical, is number one. I ask you, if you were given an empty building, or even a log for that matter, out in the woods, and a few students, and nothing except the clothing on your back, could you have a day of school with the class? You ought to be able to. You ought to be able to. There's a story of Davidson Hoosier, schoolmaster, out of print book, there's probably in many libraries. Ralph Hartsook, I think his name was, went out to take a country school there. And one of the philosophies there was no licking, no larning. You have to lick them good to get them to learn. Well, Ralph stayed at one of the homes, the school board chairman's home, overnight, and he roomed around, stayed at one place for 1 week, another place for another week. And that evening, he sat down as day after supper, and he began telling stories to the family. And he found out that not only the children who were going to be in school, and these were some older teens who went to school just a couple months each winter, and never got beyond first or second grade because they never really approached school seriously. He found that these people were starved for stories. And he proceeded to tell them story after story. And the parents sat and they listened, spellbound. And one of the, I believe his name is Bud Means, if I have the story, the name straight there. Anyway, the one brother said to the other, these stories that he's telling us, they're worth far more than, I think it was even coon hunting or something like that, something else he valued. I challenge you as a teacher, do you have something to offer? It's the teacher that makes the difference. And we have wonderful tools to use. We're blessed to have chalkboards to write on so that we can make visual illustrations. We're blessed to have paper that the children can even write. And furthermore, we're blessed to have some books that we can use as tools so that we can go with, in addition to the stories that we know, the experiences of life that we have lived, and the thinking that we've done about the experiences that we have lived. You know, it isn't the quantity of experience so much as it is what you've done with it. And I often make the comment, after you've taught 10 years, you can have any number of years of experience from 1 to 10. Some teachers teach 10 years and have 1 year of experience. And it's just repeated 10 times. And in order to gain from an experience, you need to grow. And so do we, and so in that case, that teacher was a young man. He was only probably 18 or 19 years old. And it wasn't a long life of experience he had. It was the way he engaged life. Men like Abe Lincoln, who other people read some books too, but one of his neighbors said, it just seems that Abe gets more out of books than other people get out of books. And someone else said about Abe, well, Abe wants to know more than his father wants to know. And so, are you an interested person? Do all things interest you? Are you interested in measuring trees and solving problems of various kinds, in reading stories? And are you interested in things? That's the key thing. You don't need to walk into the classroom with a great amount of information and ability. As depending on the age that you are, you enter the classroom differently. Teaching is a different experience for people of different ages. One of the things that older teachers need to learn is that you change. As life unfolds, you're no longer what you were when you were 22 years old. And you cannot be, if you're 42, you cannot be a 22-year-old teacher. And there's something changes about that. And we have to always be authentic. But the advantage that young teachers have is that you are on an adventure with your children. Adventures are fascinating. They're interesting. And it's certainly, you need to know that which you would teach. But you don't have to master the subject. It's more important that you know where you're going. We're on a journey, and we're learning. And we're on an adventure. There was one time in my experience I took my students on a genuine field trip that was an adventure. That is, we went someplace. It was along a railroad track in a, next to a county park that I had not been before. I let them know that. We're going to walk through this area. I've never been through this area before. And so we were entering this territory together for the first time. That, now, that particular hike had a different character than any other hike we ever had. And there's that aspect as we teach. If you're a young teacher, a beginning, be upfront with that. This is a new experience for me, and of course, subjects that we study are for children often a new experience. We're walking through this together. And so there's no way that you can go ahead and master all that. There's a sense in which you need to, you teach out of who you are. And so in our topic, I want to talk this morning a bit about the backside of the one sheet that I gave you on the first day that deals with reading. It's the backside of the one that has the all the writing ideas, and it looks like this. Reading across the curriculum. And it raises the question, again, why do we read? Why do we read? When I think of reading here, I'm thinking of reading things other than the purchased textbooks for the school. And whether that's packets they work through or whether that is hardbound text, we need, other material needs to be read. It supplements the text. That's the one purpose of reading beyond the textbook. Oftentimes, and as we think here, we're thinking of either the teacher reading to the students, or even just the teacher reading for his own or her own interest or background information. Or it could be the case that an individual student reads a book, or the whole class might, or you might just read from a book. Don't feel bound if you have a book that you read from in the classroom. Don't feel bound that the book needs to be read in its entirety, maybe just one reading from it. But oftentimes, what we get in a textbook is a skeleton. It's distilled information. It's generalizations, conclusions. When people say, I don't like history, that's an oxymoron, really. It's impossible to not like history. You have to define your terms. What the person is really saying is, I detest these generalizations that I'm supposed to memorize that don't mean anything to me. Or I detest the conclusions that, see, what happens is the historians, they read history. They're the ones that have all the fun. And then they take this and they distill it and concentrate and shoehorn it into a textbook. And then the student is to read the conclusions but never have the fun of the story that went behind it. And any children are born and grow up asking things like, tell me about when you were a little boy. Let me know something about my background. And stories, that is history. But anyway, fleshing out the text, putting some flesh on the text, and also giving specifics for generalizations. School books are full of generalizations, conclusions. Therefore, this calls that. Well, what are some examples? Now, some have some examples, but usually the examples are very, very succinct too. It's a bit like, what happens is that often just using the textbook is a bit like eating or living on the nutrition, the powdered nutrition that you give someone who cannot handle a full diet. And so you have something like Ensure, and you go to the drugstore and you buy the can of Ensure, and it has all the minerals and vitamins you need. And so you feed that, you eat that every day. And after a while, a person says, I hate mealtime. I've had that much of that ensure that I'm full of up to here. I don't care if I ever never see it again. And that's basically what we're saying when we say we can't stand these books that we have to read all the time. Well, what's happening is that it's up to us as teachers to make sure that the diet includes not only the ensure or whatever, but that we have some green beans and we have some potatoes and we have some bread and put some butter on sometimes and occasionally some dessert to go along with it. And that can be done. One way that can be done is the thinking skills, like we heard this morning, and this is another type of that. Stories involving things that they're reading about, whether it's animals, whether it's storms, whatever. And another one is to add the human dimension. Add the human dimension. Oftentimes books are, the information tends to be outline form, dry, and what's the human dimension here? The student wants to feel. He wants something he can care about. Remember that word care. Why should I care about this lesson? And he wants to actually experience something, to see something, or to experience the applications. In case of science or some other subjects, depending what you read to them, they can experience their applications. And sometimes replace the text for a chosen topic. You might put away the text entirely. See, the text is a tool, and it's a good tool. But our purpose is to teach the concepts, whether it's math, to teach those concepts, and to equip the student to be able to solve the problems he's to be able to solve, and also to learn the history. So these are some reasons to read. Why or what do we read? I put nonfiction at the top of the list here. If you visit schools and check the libraries, such libraries as exist in the school, typically you find a very large section of storybooks or fiction and a small section of nonfiction. Nonfiction books are expensive, and they aren't maybe as much fun to read, and everybody will not read them. But it is whether it's a book on sound or ants or shapes, whatever, children need to have access to good nonfiction books. Now, that might mean visiting the local library and getting 10 at a time, bringing them to the school, putting them up, and you have to keep record of the books you get out, and also make sure that they're all back in school in time to be sent home. But it can be done. When you're reading any given unit, so you're going to start studying stars or insects, bees, or whatever, if you can collect a handful of books on that subject and set them out, make them available, or if they're in your library, call attention to them, pull them off the shelf, put them out where they're visible, and read from them a bit. Students often learn quite a bit more from reading a book or two on a subject like that than they do from the text itself, depending on how the text is used. Magazine articles. Magazines, you might want to introduce several kinds of magazines, worthwhile ones, to your class. So you may want to visit a newsstand and pick some decent magazines, and they can become aware that there is such a thing as Christian history, there is such a thing as Scientific American, there is such a thing as needlework or whatever. There are many magazines on many subjects. You don't need to get many subscriptions. There may be no subscriptions at your school, but bringing in some, or cutting out articles, bringing them in, and clipping articles and keeping them for future years. And by the way, just a little side here, as you teach, you do want to learn to file things. And when you come across something good, a quote, an article, and you think of a time where that would fit, oh, that would be an excellent thing to have available when we study ants again. Well, you have to have some way of filing that so that when you study ants again, it will be available. And that's up to your imagination to do that, but have some kind of a filing system. Biographies. Very important for children to read biographies and to, in fact, I think it would be defensible to have a class in school. If you want to rethink your curriculum, consider having math, science, history, biography. Just a little fault there for you. The lives of people, people who have lived. We take instruction from people's lives. And all different kinds of people, inventors, Bible people, people famous in political history, people famous for a humanitarian good. Make sure that your children have access. And when you read to your children, when you read aloud, when you read in story time, make sure you read a variety of books and include some of these in. And you needn't read a whole book the whole way through from cover to cover when you read it to them. Sometimes just reading a chapter from it. If the book's available, some children will read it. That's especially true if you would read nonfiction. And then fiction. Fiction, good fiction is true. Trash fiction is not true. Anything that's worthwhile reading that's good fiction has in fact happened many times and is happening today all over the world. And the person, the story that you read, the particular story that you read, might have a different name, it might have a different address, but in fact it's happening all over the world. And you can take much instruction from reading good fiction. I alluded to a book, The Bronze Bell, a common one set in historical times. The names are chosen and assigned there, but the things that happened in that book happened thousands of times, and the same kinds of things are happening today. That's the value of reading good fiction. And then primary sources of various kinds. And sometimes students should be aware that there are primary sources. So in history, you talk about the Magna Carta or the Constitution. Well, at some point, they ought to see a copy of some of these primary documents. They might not read the whole way through the whole thing, but just reading from it and being aware what it's like reading a primary document. Letters and diaries. There are some famous ones. Diary of John Woolman or Diary of Anne Frank that you could read from. There are occasionally some recordings that can be played and maxims and quotes, which we heard about this morning. Great, great thing to read from. It doesn't take long to read one. And you don't have to analyze every one either. You can just read some and let them settle with that. When, how, and where do you read? Well, you can do it in class. As part of the history class, reading aloud to students doesn't have to happen just in, quote, story time. It can actually be part of a class. I challenge you to think about that. So you want to study a certain time period in history, and you might decide to go deep at one of these places where I mentioned the other day about reading something of everything and everything of something. At some point, you might want to read large sections out of whether it's Uncle Tom's Cabin or whether it's some other historical book that really has a setting in a certain time period. There isn't time to experience everything when you read history. There's not time. But at some time during the year, they ought to go deep and realize that in everything we study, every topic could be as interesting as this one where we stopped and actually had time to read a story about it or write a story about it. And in class, it can be done individually or in groups. They can be assigned to look something up, to read something, to share a book. At dismissal time, in just a couple minutes, you can read a quote. You can read from a book if it's not too big. Before lunch, story time, and in devotions, as part of devotions, you can read to children. I'd like to just talk about a couple other things related to reading. There is a book on the market. It's not. It has to be purchased from the author, actually, Kevin Washburn. If you're really interested, it's up here. You can get the phone number and the information in the back. But this is a teacher has done this. He went through, collected all the titles of children's books that he knew of that had anything to do with history, and then it starts with the years of 5 BC from the time of Christ up until the contemporary scene. And he has the title of the book, and it's an annotated bibliography and a little description of the subject of the book, and also points out how the book would fit in. So, for example, 1866 to 1943, a book called The Country Artist, and it fits in with literary history and Beatrix Potter. And it says, having spent her childhood surrounded by private tutors and house servants, Beatrix Potter, by age 20, longed to venture outside the confines of her parents' English estate. She longed to bring her love for country, for children and animals together in written and illustrated form. Soon, her tale of Peter Rabbit, written as a letter to a sick child, became a welcome remedy for every child in England. Once they discovered the beauty of her soft illustrations and sweet stories, children and publishers alike begged for more. This heartwarming biography of a sensitive child and talented woman will undoubtedly steal the hearts of young readers. Now, there's a description like that of each book, and it gives you about enough information to decide whether it's a book that you would be interested in or not. It's not a cheap book. It's, I think it's $12 plus $4 shipping and handling to order from the publisher. But by paging through a book like this, you can pick out titles that you could maybe get at the public library, or some of them would be available in local bookstores, or you could purchase. There are two other more common books that give you good titles if you need titles of books to read to children. One is called Honey for a Child's Heart, and I think that's probably available down here in COR. And I believe the author is Gladys Hunt. Does anybody know for sure on the author on that one? The other is the Read Aloud Handbook. There's also the New Read Aloud Handbook by Jim Trelease. Both those books emphasize the importance of reading aloud to children of all ages, including high school age. And in the back, about half the book has bibliographies, extended annotated bibliographies of different kinds of books and the age groups they're suggested that they be used for. And so the reading across the curriculum, there are books. There's a book called City Under the Back Steps, in which two children are bitten by, it's fantasy, they're bitten by an ant in the back lawn, and they get small because they're bitten. They become ant-sized and live with the ants for a couple weeks. And in the process of reading that book, you learn all about how ants live. You learn about slaves. You learn about the aphids, the milking ants, and the wars between ants, the red ants, the black ants, the white ants. You actually live with them. And you also learn how weak a person is in ant size. And at the end of the story, they come back to real size again. Now, you need to find your books like that. You might want to scour the library, but if you're doing an insect study, and especially in elementary grades, and you read a book like that to them, well, the truth is a book could be written like that about every insect there is. And ants are fascinating. But so are bees, so are caterpillars, so are of all kinds. And children become aware that there's a breadth of material out here to learn. Everything's interesting. Life is not long enough to begin to learn everything about everything. But we pick out some things and introduce them to them in a way that's both informative and imaginative. In history, reading some, an excellent book that everyone should be introduced to is Carl Sandburg's biography of Abe Lincoln. Now, he wrote three volumes, but the first one is the most famous, The Prairie Years. And someone has taken that book, The Prayer Years by Carl Sandburg, and actually taken excerpts from it and put together a smaller volume, but keeping the same words. And I'll just read an excerpt here. And notice how here in reading this, you get some the style. You learn about Abe Lincoln, but you also learn some history here. That year of 1816, I should back up a bit more. One night, Abe tried to sleep while his head was working on the meaning of the heavy and mysterious words standing dark on the pages of the family Bible. The stories his mother told him from those pages, all the people in the world drowned, the world covered with water, even Indiana and Kentucky, all people drowned except Noah and his family, the man Jonah swallowed by a whale, and after days coming out of the belly of the whale, the last day to come, the stars dropping out of the sky, the world swallowed up in fire. And one night, this boy felt the southwest wind blowing the log fire smoke into his nostrils. And there was a hoot owl crying and a shaking of branches in the beeches and walnuts outside, so that he went to the south opening of the shed and looked out on the winter sky with a high quarter moon and a white shine of thin frost on the long open spaces of the sky. And an old wonder took a deeper hold on him, a wonder about the loneliness of life down there in the Indiana wilderness, and a wonder about what was happening in other places over the world, places he had heard people mention, cities, rivers, flags, wars, Jerusalem, Washington, Baltimore. He might have asked the moon, "What do you see?" And the moon might have told him many things. That year of 1816, the moon had seen 16,000 wagons come along one turnpike in Pennsylvania, heading west, with people hungry for new land, a new home, just like Tom Lincoln had. Up the Mississippi River that year had come the first steamboat to curve into the Ohio River and land passengers at Louisville. The moon had seen the first steamboat leave Pittsburgh and tie up in New Orleans. New wheels, wagons were coming, an iron horse snorting fire and smoke. Rolling mills, ingots, iron, steel were the talk of Pennsylvania. A sheet copper mill was starting in Massachusetts. The moon could see 8 million people in the United States, white men who had pushed the Indians over the eastern mountains, fighting to clear the Great Plains and the southern valleys of the red men. At Fallen Timbers, in a Tippecanoe in Indiana, and down at the Great Bend of the Tallapoosa, the pale faces and copper faces had yelled and grappled, and Weatherford had said, "I have done the white people all the harm I could. If I had an army, I would fight to the last. My warriors can no longer hear my voice. Their bones are at Talladega, Tallahatchie's, Emmett Fall, and Topeka. I can do no more than weep." And then I'll jump down a bit here. Seldom had the moon seen, in its thousands of years of looking down on the earth and human family, such a man as the Napoleon Bonaparte, whose bayonets had been going in Europe for 15 years. Shoving kings off thrones, changing laws, maps, books, raising armies, using them up, raising new armies, until people in some regions were saying, "The red roses of this year grow from the blood-wet ground of the wars we fought last year." And at last, the terrible Napoleon was caged, jailed on the lonely island of St. Helena, crying for the liberty and equality of France to be spread over the world. He had led armies to believe and dream of beating down all other armies in Europe that tried to stand against him. Then he was a lean shadow. He had become fat. The paunch stuck out further than it is allowed to conquerors. He had hugged armfuls of battle flags to his breast while telling an army of soldiers, "I cannot embrace you all, but I do so in the person of your general." It hurt his ears when, captured and being driven in an open carriage, he heard sarcastic people along the streets mock at him with the call, "Long live the Emperor!" He would die, far from home, with regrets, the first man to be Napoleonic. Such were a few of the many, many things the moon might have told little Abe Lincoln, 8 years old, on a winter night in 1816 on Little Pigeon Creek in the Buckhorn Valley in southern Indiana. A high quarter moon with a white shine of thin frost on the long open spaces of the sky. He was of the blood and breath of many of these things and will know them better in the years to come. Now, every person's life story is as fascinating as Abe Lincoln's. Yours is, and so is every one of your students. It's the telling of the story that is critical. Every subject is interesting. It's the recognition of the interest and the telling of the story and the way it's presented that counts. And so you need a large quantity, but you need some good stories and you need some really good books at your disposal that you introduce your students to. The question came up of what about these ideas that are afloat in our world, what about worldviews? Well, you need to introduce your children to some people who stood tall and walked worthy. And these people, and you need to introduce them to various kinds of people. That's what history is full of. And these people are not all model Christians, but there's instruction we can take from their lives. Some things we can do, other ones we can avoid. So, familiarize yourself with books. There are, this one I noticed is over here in COR. Ireland, potato famine. I recall going to school in history, learning about four or five facts. 1845, important date. Ireland, potato famine. People died, potatoes rotted, people came here by the thousands. Worked, built our canals. That's about the extent of what I knew about Ireland and potato famine. Now, it's significant to know that, but there's a story behind that. It was 35 years later I learned that at the time the Irish people were dying of famine because their potatoes rotted. There was a good crop of wheat in Ireland, plenty of wheat. But the Irish could not eat it. Their land was owned by English landlords, and the wheat was exported. The Irish starved. The English landlords did not care about them. And this book, Beyond the Western Sea, The Escape from Home, deals with has three children leaving Ireland, coming to this country, and there's a sequel to this, and surviving in this country. Now, you don't have time to read books about all the events of history, but something, somewhere, sometime, the children ought to have the experience of seeing the human dimension. This really did happen. And they ought to be aware, at least, that behind everything you read in the history book, there is a story, a big story. And we don't have time to learn all the stories. But one of the challenges that you face one of the struggles we have when we teach a content subject is giving enough of the big picture so the students are not totally unknowing, totally ignorant of whole areas of things they should be aware of. And so they don't say, I didn't so much as hear that there was such a thing as a civil war or a revolutionary war, or that didn't know there was a transcontinental railroad or a Great Plains. On the other hand, to know only those general facts and not have any story is we're really shortchanging them. They're missing probably the most vital part. And so I'd suggest as you teach your content subjects, your history, your health, and your science, yes, you want to give that big scope. In some cases, say, class, I'm going to tell you about chapter 18. This is what happened here. and give it to them and give them the overview. Move on, and some other time when you get to an area, and especially the first, as you begin teaching, pick the area that you are already interested in and know something about, and at some point, go deep in reading to them. Reading to children in Bible. The War for Man's Soul has been reprinted. John Bunyan wrote a classic called The Holy War. Ethel Barrett read it years ago, and she was grieved when she read it because she said, it's such a good book, and I'm afraid that perhaps John Bunyan and I are the only two that worked our way through it. It's in the original. Who ever read The Holy War? Anybody? The Holy War. All right? Try it sometime. It's this story. But the way it's told is very, for us, very, very difficult to read. But she said, here is a story that needs to be told. It is, the story is there, but the way it's told is very, very ponderous. And so she retold it. And it was out of print for a while, but now it's back in print, The War for a Man's Soul. And it's the story of your life. And I'll just read one part of it here. Man's soul is a person, and the various parts of man's soul are personified. And so the characters who live in man's soul is people living inside a palace. And then there's an ear gate, and there's an eye gate, and a nose gate, and so on. And then there's a Lord conscience and a Lord will, and so on. And the different parts that make up the person are pulled apart into separate characters, and they interact with each other. Well, at one point, the ear gate opens, and Diabolus comes, Satan comes, and he takes over man's soul by man's soul's own will. And here's just a bit out of the one chapter, and Diabolus is speaking. Liar! Diabolus' voice rang through the castle as he burst into the foyer. Liar! He made his way to the chamber of state. Liar, he gasped, leaning against the door. Are you calling somebody, one asked his warlords. No, I want one, he said. Get me the biggest liar you can find. But sire, they said, you have that honor. You are the biggest liar in the universe. Oh yes, he remembered. Yeah, I lost my head. Another council of war is advisable, they wanted to know. Another council of war is inevitable, he said. Do you think Emmanuel's next move will be to fight, said Beelzebub. I think he will get his battering rams and slings ready to assault ear gate and eye gate. Certainly he will give us battle, said Diabolus. But there is no way lawfully to take man's soul except to get in by the gates. Well, I think he will give man's soul another chance to surrender peacefully. Now, that is just a sample, but as you read through this, it presents the parts of your person as separate characters. And man's soul begins innocent, he falls, and then he again comes to back to relationship with Emmanuel at the end and sits down feasting with him. And we see the dynamics of that. And then we hear these little comments such as this one. There's no way to lawfully take man's soul except to get in by the gates, by his own will. There are books available like this for science or math that actually put a bit of story. I give you a bit of the background of famous mathematicians. There's an example here of Archimedes, who made the statement that if I could have a place to stand, I could move the earth. And of course, the king said, you couldn't do that. He said, I could, because if I had enough mechanical advantage. And so they gave him a challenge. There was a ship in the harbor, and they said it takes many, many, many slaves to man the oars to make this ship move. And he said, I can move it by myself. And so they gave him the opportunity to try that. And everybody in the city heard about it, so they all crowded around there to watch. And the king had loaded it down with as many passengers and freight as he possibly could. Archimedes did not seem in the least troubled. He was busy with a series of ropes and wheels that ran from the ship to a helix that was fastened on the dock. The helix looked like a big screw with handles on it. After Archimedes had checked the ropes and wheels, he stood calmly with his fingers on the handle. "Let me know when you're ready," called Hiero anxiously. "Do you need more time? Would you like someone to help you, or is this a joke?" "I'm ready," said Archimedes, smiling. He started turning the handle. The crowd laughed and shouted. Then, with a great gasp, they leaned forward to look more closely. The ship was moving. Archimedes was using only one hand, slowly turning the handle, drawing the cords around the helix. But still, the ship was moving. She came out of the slip slowly, but as smoothly as if she had been on the sea, sailing under a steady wind. A roar went up from the crowd. "Who said he was a little crazy?" they asked each other. They almost all of them had. Now they looked at him in awe. Archimedes motioned for the king to take the handle. The king turned it nervously, but still the ships moved smoothly and steadily. He stopped and held up his hand. "Everyone hear this," he shouted. "I order from this day on that Archimedes is to be believed in anything he says." Wow, that gives you something to talk about, doesn't it? So, find yourself some books that you like and some that you read in your growing up. Those are some of your best tools. Some of your best tools. They are your experience. You teach out of who you are, teach out of your experience. As some of you heard Mr., I guess it was Kohler, say the other day about a teacher who had been to Europe and in teaching geography did not put together the fact that since she had been in Europe, that would have anything to do with her teaching geography of Europe. And so, but it's possible to go into the classroom and teach and not realize that the experiences you've had in life and the books you have read in your growing up have anything to do with your teaching. They have everything to do with your teaching. There's hardly anything that can happen in your life that doesn't become somehow an illustration that fits. Those who've been in my classes know that whatever happens, whether it was an accident that occurred, whether I was a firefighter for a number of years, whether it was an event at a fire, something I've read, whether it's a math class, a science class, there are things out of your own life that apply as illustrations and explanations and analogies for things that you teach. So you don't have to go out and find a whole pile of new books. Think of what you have read. What did you read and appreciate when you were 10 and 12 and 15 and 18? Those are things that you can identify with and then turn around and use, refer to it somehow. Yesterday we ended with your little task of writing something for math. Let's go to that now, and I'd like to hear something that you wrote for a math activity. Who's not ready? Who's not ready to read yours? Anybody? Okay. Let's hear yours. Yes. You want to stand up? Here, I'll hold the mic up.
I just wrote a little story problem, which I think quite a few of y'all did. I wrote a problem illustrating fractions involving the different classmates in your class. Let's say we have a class that has 12 students and 4 are boys. And then you can ask the questions, what fraction are boys, what fraction are girls, and what is the ratio of boys to girls?
Good. Student made up a problem. Do you have one? Carla, do you have one? Do you have one? You do it, right?
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Will you read it?
Okay, I wrote a set of numbered directions for solving a problem. I chose to do adding fractions. I'll let y'all decide if they're clear or not. I said the first step is to find the LCD, and then you want to convert the fractions so that both fraction has this LCD. proceed to add the numerators. The numerator of the new fraction will be the sum of your previous numerators, and the denominator is LCD. Do not add denominators, and denominators must be the same before you combine numerators.
Thank you. A good activity to do would be to assign everybody the same kind of problem. Say, explain how to subtract fractions that have different denominators or something like that. And then everybody explains the same problem. And then you exchange directions and say, now you take his paper and you do exactly the way he said you're to do it. And see if you get the right answer. And then if you get the wrong answer, then you and he can have an argument, a debate, I guess is a better word. And you convince him that you followed his directions precisely and got the wrong answer. And he can convince you that he had the directions written properly, but you didn't interpret them properly. And it would lead you into a discussion of, were you really clear? Were you clear? How precise was your explanation of how to do it? And the purpose of this thing is precise thinking. There's a close call, and I wouldn't argue that if you can't, I know it's very true that you can solve problems in math without being able to articulate how to do them. But nevertheless, it is a worthwhile activity to try to articulate them. There are people who can intuitively solve problems without any idea of how they got the answer, and those are some of those are the people who go on to be the Einsteins, but most of us aren't the Einsteins. Let's hear a couple more. Somebody back here.
This one probably wouldn't work for everyone, but recently we had, the last several years we had several factories shut down in our area, so this is one concerning the community. Simply have the students figure up how many people are actually unemployed in our area using the percentage of unemployment that we have and the population area.
Good. Something from current events. Practical problem that's out there. There are often charts and percentages and so on in the newspaper regarding unemployment or and so on. Let's have one more over here somewhere.
Go ahead. We recently had a lot of flash floods in our area, so that's what I chose here. Johnny went to Cherry Creek and built a mud castle over lunch. After school the next day, which was 3:30, he went down and looked, and the water was 2 yards over the castle. How many inches per hour was the average increase of the water depth?
Very good. I have a handout here. Maybe you could get somebody to help you and pass them out. I'd like to begin talking a bit about writing activities in language arts and Bible. Language arts perhaps is a bit self-evident that writing is part of that. So I won't say as much about it other than to give a list here that's a bit self-explanatory. I do want to point out that one item that I should have had in my 12 writing forms, maybe to make it 13, the summary is a very, very valuable form of writing. And as we talk about these writing activities, some of you might be wondering, well, when would I ever have my students do this? It keeps us busy to do all the work that's in the book. Well, I simply say don't do all the work in the book. The exercises in the book are intended to give children practice to learn either develop the skill or learn the content of what they're to learn. And sometimes some of these writing things are activities to do instead of discussing something in class. Other ones could be alternate assignments. Instead of doing the question box, you do this writing assignment instead. Now, looking down over the language arts writing activities, a summary. It's a very important skill to teach, and it's difficult to teach. A good summary has an overview. You cannot summarize something if you don't understand it. And that's why a summary is so valuable. You can have summaries of any content, subject, or stories, or even a math lesson, really. But it gives you the big picture, the overview. This is what is going on here. But it has to include some detail to substantiate what is going on. And so, for example, if you were writing a summary of the hare and the tortoise, a bad summary would be there was a race between a couple animals and one of them won. Well, did you understand the story? Do you know what the story was really about? Or you might say a hare raced a tortoise and he won. That now we know at least that you know what happened in the story. That's not a good summary. Students who are to summarize typically make several errors. One is they retell the story. And they say, a hare wanted to race the animals, and they proceed to tell the story, and then they realize that they have about as many words as they're supposed to have for the summary, so they stop. Or else they might jump to the end and say, and then he won. And so they've actually told the first third of the story, and then the conclusion, they think that's a summary. That's not a summary. You're not to retell the story. That's, by the way, that's a valid activity, retelling something in your own words, paraphrasing. But that's not a summary. And another one is to be too general, and then another one is to be too specific and say something like, a hare was very proud, and he went around and tried to get all the animals to race him, and they wouldn't. The tortoise was very humble, and he was willing to tackle it, and the tortoise won. Well, that's some of the details there, but we didn't really tie that together. So, in a summary, you should say something like, a hare and a tortoise, a hare challenged the animals to a race, but none of them would take him on. Finally, the tortoise did. And the hare accepted the challenge, or the tortoise accepted the challenge. The hare was very happy because he knew he could easily win the race. But he got so proud that he lay down, took a nap, and while he napped, the tortoise won. Something like that, that gives you, in a few words, the big picture, but also enough detail that we really know some specifics that happened in it. So, summaries. Other language arts activity to add to a story, rewrite the ending, and that way you have 12 students, you have 12 endings. Some of them, they won't like it. They're, no, it can't end that. Well, that's the way I ended it. character sketches include, and you can find books that give you ideas on developing these, but in a character sketch, you introduce this to the person well enough so that we can know him if he walked into the room by what he says, how he reacts, and so on. It's important in teaching reading that children understand, whether you use the terms or not, they ought to understand the difference between the plot of a story and the theme of a story. And I wrote two down there. The plot is actually the plan of action. What happened? But the theme is what it's about. And you could write, pride will eventually embarrass you. You could write 1,000 stories on that theme. You could use the ants, you could use people, you could use all kinds of settings with the theme that pride will eventually embarrass you. Or people make up logical excuses for their inabilities. That theme, you could write 1,000 different stories illustrating that theme. And each one would have its own plot. And the plot is the plan of action. Book reports. Give some attention to that. Your book reports can easily become a thorn in the student's side. I love to read books, but I hate to do book reports. Well, you work very hard to not allow them to retell the story. That's not what you're after. It's not in most book reports. In nonfiction, have them come right to the heart of it. What is this book about, and what are some things you learned? And, I mean, it's already in the book. I tell them it's the book. It's already in here. You do not need to write the book a second time. That's not the goal. And with fiction, summarize the plot. Pull that together. What happened? And then pick out a main character. Tell us something about him. What kind of a person was he? What did he do? And what is the theme? What are some themes that are brought out in this book? Often there's more than one. And here's one I like to push. Tell something you learned. And students will say, I didn't learn anything. Well, yes, you did. You did. You, in fact, are pretty much what you read. You're influenced by what you read, by what you read. And many, many books of fiction will influence the way you think. Your impressions of the West, of the United States, are very much going to be influenced by stories that you read about, whether it's, if you read a book about the Oregon Trail or something, your impressions of, are going to be created by some of the storybooks you read. And, or sometimes you can ask them to, what is something you think you'll remember 5 years from now, if anything, from this book? And be sure they practice a variety of forms of writing, all different kinds. As you assign writing, don't stick to just one kind, but and give them models. Do some yourself sometimes. Try some of these yourself. You don't need to do all the assignments your students do, but if you can't describe, you really can't help your students describe something well. So practice all the forms of writing. And then on the back side, some of these are self-explanatory. I think I'll pick up on these tomorrow. Tomorrow I would like to, in our concluding time, we'll do deal with Bible, music, and art. I'll have an activity for the art one for you to try, and on writing. And then also I'll talk a bit about speaking across the curriculum tomorrow. I might mention...
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.